You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 8th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author, podcast host, Kurt Anderson, on his latest Evil Genius, The Unmasking of America, A Recent History. Meanwhile, the 2020 election goes into high gear and Trump's money advantage disappears. Trump announces that he will present a new list of potential Supreme Court nominees on Wednesday, a key part of his 2016 victory. Meanwhile, the House Oversight Committee to investigate the reports that Louis DeJoy, Postmaster General, reportedly was involved in illegal campaign donations. Experts fear that a COVID surge in the lead up to the November election cresting just after it. The AP reports of fears of a tripling of absentee ballot rejections, and Secretary of State's expect delayed results on, well, election week. The left begins to contemplate MAGA violence if Trump loses. Federal judge rules the NSA delayed data collection illegal 7 years later. And a judge orders the census field ops to continue, at least for the moment. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I am broadcasting from the studio today, all by my lonesome. It's a little bit lonely in here, but I haven't made the full transition, but we're going to be doing that sometimes here and sometimes other places. And oddly enough, this studio is more difficult to broadcast from in this COVID age because it's not built for people to be remote. It's built for everybody to be here. So Matt had to run down to the office to fix things this morning. So kudos to Matt. He came in, he had his own oxygen tank and came in the bubble here into the... But Matt, was this the first time you've been in the office in months?
Yeah, I snuck in once, like early in COVID, to grab some supplies, but that was the last time.
I see you left your Pop-Tarts, though.
I know, I thought about grabbing those, but they'll still be good for me whenever this is over.
There's a slight chance that I may throw them out. I hope that's all right with you.
Oh, I don't know. We'll talk.
I mean,
about that.
I guess I'll check the date, and if they, you could leave those things open, right? And they'd still be good 6, 7, 8 months later.
Well, that's how you can toast them in the open air that way.
Right.
So them dry out.
Right. All right. Well, that's good.
No, like the bargaining's coming up, so.
Yeah. There's. We'll see. We'll see what I do with those Pop-Tarts, but. Yeah, this office needs a cleaning. It looks a little bit disheveled, and we're going to rework it, but it will work for the time being. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. I know we've got our guest waiting. We've got a couple ads here to get to. And then one of the things I've always said that's important to me is that I do not like – now, this is a little idiosyncratic – but I was on the whole, I don't want to put aluminum under my arms. And I don't know what diseases are going to come from that or whatnot. But I've always been very skeptical, I have to say, of any of the, I don't want to say all hygienic products, but many. And so I believe, for me, that reading the label on any of this stuff that you put on you is hugely important. I do it with food. I do it with a bunch of stuff. Well, that's why my deodorant is Native. Native is made with ingredients you've actually heard of, like coconut oil, shea butter, tapioca starch. Although, to be fair, I never heard of that. But they don't use things like aluminum or parabens or sulfates or talc. It's also vegan. It's never tested on animals. Native just released plastic-free deodorant made from 100% paperboard and shipped in a plastic-free bag. Switching to an aluminum-free deodorant doesn't mean you have to sacrifice on odor protection. Native will keep you smiling and feeling fresh all day. Native comes in over 10 scents like coconut, vanilla, lavender, and rose, plus rotating seasonals like pumpkin spice latte collection. Native is risk-free to try, has free shipping in the U.S., and a free 30-day returns and exchanges. Now, even short-time listeners of this program will know that I have a very low threshold of tolerance for any type of smell. And so, for me, my favorite scent of Native is the unscented. I did try the coconut. I liked it. Coconut, I can handle. Anything that has anything that's like floral, I'm not good with. I'm allergic to it, or I don't know what it is. But I've been using the Native unscented, and it works great. Got me off of those, like, I don't know. They have, like, sort of wooey type of stuff that is, you know, it doesn't work. But the Native unscented has been great for me. So do what I did. Switch to Native today by going to nativedeo.com/majority. That's nativedeo.com/majority, or use the promo code majority at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/majority, or use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first order. Also, this episode brought to you by Magic Spoon. Had some this morning. So didn't my kid. It's one of the few things that we like to eat together now. And as you remember, breakfast cereal, one of the best parts of being a kid. This is actually going to come up in the interview today with Kurt Anderson a little bit, because there's a certain amount of nostalgia that people have for cereals when they were younger. Now, the problem with the cereals that you had when you were a kid is that they were junky, full of sugar and all sorts of other crap. I know, Matt, I know you don't, because you're a millennial, you don't eat cereal, because that would mean you'd have to clean a bowl or something, right? But you could eat it out of the box.
Well, can't get milk in there.
That's true. You can't, but I know, but that way you don't have to do any cleaning. But there's an easier way to relive the magic of your childhood without eating all that junk food. Magic Spoon is a new cereal company. It's discovered a way to recreate your favorite childhood cereals with 0 grams of sugar, 11 grams of protein, and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. They offer 4 flavors based on the all-time classics: cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry. You can figure out what those all-time classics were. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to mention those or not, but in my household, it is the cocoa and the fruity. I'm the cocoa, my kid's the fruity. But I will say this. Well, in addition to it being keto friendly, it's gluten free, it's grain free, it's soy free, it's low carbon, it's GMO free. Look, I'm a cocoa guy. They have other flavors that you should check out. I don't know. They're not into like us talking about those other flavors, but I've tried them all. We get a lot of cereal from these guys now. It is the primary breakfast meal, and sometimes I'll be honest with you, I can't sleep at night. I get up at 3 in the morning, I have a bowl of cereal. And it's always Magic Spoon, because it's not full of garbage. It's delicious. Go to magicspoon.com/majority report. You grab a variety pack, you try it today. Be sure to use our promo code Majority Report at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it is backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code Majority Report for free shipping I want to thank Magic Spoon both for sponsoring the show and, frankly, for allowing me to give my kids some cereal in the morning that I don't feel bad about, that I actually feel good about. And Saul looks at the label and he's just like, "Dad, this has no grams of sugar." It's weird what you get proud of about your kid. All right. Lastly, as you know, one of our premier sponsors is Sunset Lake CBD. They are a CBD grower and seller, I guess, located in Vermont, just outside of Burlington. They work with the University of Vermont with their regenerative farming agricultural practices. All of their CBD is 100% pesticide free. They only use organic fertilizers. They have a third party test that you can see on their website. You can get it certified, et cetera, et cetera. They have great business practices, $15 minimum wage. The company is majority employee owned. If you like to smoke cannabis, but you don't want to get super stoned, like the heady stoned, but just like the body stoned, Matt can speak to the multitude of different ways that they have for you to do that. There's pre-rolls. They sent me a big, one of those big spleefs. Matt is digging it. What is your favorite? The smalls or something?
The smalls. Yeah. The nugs come in these little small, I guess, nuggets, and they go right in the grinder. You don't even have to break them apart with your hands.
But they also have gummies, which are fantastic. They've got tincture, which I use. Is it tincture? I guess that's what it is. Yep. They have a salve that is great that I've been using. Now, to be honest with you, I got an email. Somebody said they tried it on their eczema. It didn't work, but they love this stuff anyways for their joints and whatnot. But for me, I found the salve to work on my eczema. I've sent it to a bunch of other people. They have Farmer's Roast CBD coffee. Check it out. If you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. Left is best, one word, 20% off of all their CBD products. You cannot go wrong. Try it out. We were all CBD skeptics here before. And now I'm leaning on it. Maybe a little too much, but it's, you know, stressful times, folks. All right. Should we do this quick video, Matt, Brendan?
I think we should bring him on.
Okay. All right. Let's take a quick break. Oh, do we have him on Zoom?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep, here he comes.
Let me bring to the program Kurt Anderson. He was the co-founder of Spy Magazine, former editor-in-chief at New York Magazine, author of many books. His latest book is Evil Genius, The Unmasking of America, A Recent History, which is, in many respects, Kurt, a companion volume to Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, A 500-Year History. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
Let me also say, and this is really... I don't know if it's really been a slight for you, but it's, I want to apologize to both my audience and myself for not having you on, before now. I've got to tell you that turn of the century, this is, we're going back a little bit, but your book, Turn of the Century, has resonated, for me for 20 years.
And, wow. How nice of you.
And I don't know what it was that took me so long to do this, but, what you've done here, it's fascinating. It's almost like you have done because many of the things you're talking about in Evil Geniuses is, a lot of what we talk about on this program quite a bit. We had Rick Perlstein on the other day, whose most recent, book was, sort of the last, or maybe not the last, covering a lot of the period where a lot of this change happened, that you write about. And you've written both a political but also cultural, history that is accessible about how we got off track. But let's start with Fantasyland a little bit, because this, it was almost like, if I understand correctly, in Fantasyland, you sort of outlined a problem that we had in this country. And then afterwards you sort of said, like, wait, how did we get here?
Well, exactly. There's kind of two separate problems. The problem in Fantasyland is basically, as I discovered after researching it for some years and writing the book, is that we have this deep-seated American love of the excitingly untrue. right? And that was okay up to a point, because the grown-ups who believed in rationality were in charge. And so, you know, whatever. As Thomas Jefferson said, and I quote him many times in that book, if it doesn't, I don't care what anybody believes. The government shouldn't try to stop anyone from believing anything as long as it doesn't break my leg or pick my pocket. I'm with that. But then it did start breaking our legs and picking our pockets when it was politically exploited and weaponized, this kind of crazy thinking of anything is true and conspiracy theories that aren't true and all the rest. That was the story of Fantasyland. It was sort of organic. That was in the bloodstream of America, you know, from way back. And it was this like chronic condition that became an acute illness in the last couple of decades and allowed Donald Trump, the great symptom of it, to become president. So then I finished that and I realized, wait, that is only half the story. There was something else. Believing in crazy things and aliens running the government or whatever it is you believe did not change our system the way it was changed when I was a young man, right? I mean, I grew up in one version of America that was fair and still the New Deal idea was still there and all boats rose together and rich people paid a lot more taxes and all the rest. Then that stopped. And even though I was around and a writer and sometimes a journalist during that period of the 70s and 80s, well, 80s anyway, I realized looking back now that I hadn't fully noticed what had happened. And it was that these people, guys, who I won't call it a conspiracy, but it was certainly, I call it repeatedly in the book, a confederacy of these guys who were either right-wing ideological zealots, Milton Friedmanites, or rich people, or CEOs. And they created a whole strategy and battle plan and counter-establishment to make America what it became, where only the well-to-do and big business get richer and more powerful.
And of course, you know, I mean, I think, you know, you certainly have mentioned that era that we were talking about, the big difference, right, between that era where we had the Great Compression and we had that we were in the post or in the wake of the New Deal, I guess, was that it was in many respects reserved for a segment of the population. There were segments of the population, black people and women to a large extent. In many respects, large swaths, if not the majority of the population, yeah, didn't necessarily enjoy that in the same manner.
But, right.
But what was
they didn't.
It?
And God knows we don't want to go back in time in terms of the way white supremacy was more supreme and patriarchy was more supreme. But economically, and this book, Evil Genius, is not about the whole right wing and the anti-abortion crazies and all that. They're there because they became the political allies of the economic right, the Kochs and that ilk. And so I'm focusing on economic unfairness. Economic fairness for all households, black and white, during the, you know, 50s and 60s and 70s was increasing. All boats were rising together. Now, yes, there was a gigantic gap between white households and black households and still is, and it's egregious and awful. But as the economy grew and productivity grew, all households were sharing in that equal. Rich people and middle-class people and poor people shared equally in that rise. And then they stopped. And, you know, and we used to have an aggressive antitrust enforcement against corporate power when it got too big. We used to pay half the workers in America overtime. We stopped. You know, all these things that just, we, as though there was a giant national referendum and we changed it so that 80% of Americans are economically less fair. But yes, to your point, it wasn't all... My make America great again is not going back in the ways that Donald Trump and his cult wants to go back. But there was a bit there back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, which is to say economic fairness, that wasn't going too badly.
All right. And so, and I want to spend, you know, more time on the cultural stuff. I mean, we, over the past couple of weeks, we have talked, we've had many talks about the, what you mentioned in terms of the antitrust and the change during the Reagan era, where the calculus for what constituted monopoly changed from being sort of more citizen and about competition, broadly speaking, and about citizenry to just simply prices and under Bork and whatnot. And I want to get to that a little bit. But in terms of the fantasy land thing, this notion of, because I'm also fascinated about this character of the American people, and I reference this book far too often, but Emily Odgen's Credulity, about mesmerism and about how there's a long history in this country of people wanting, you know, buying into sort of some of these fantasies and in their relationship with the people who tell them that. What is the relationship between what took place starting in the early 70s, really in many respects, in the wake of the emancipation of women and of Black people to the extent that, you know, they have become emancipated, at least from a legal perspective? What is it about the development of these fantasies? Is it how is that related specifically to all the changes that took place that have economically very slowly, almost like, you know, the frog doesn't know he's boiling type of situation? Yeah.
I would say certainly, first of all, what I found out in this book and talk about in Evil Geniuses is that the battle plan was starting way before Ronald Reagan, way before 1980. They had a whole decade of planning. And again, I really had no idea. But I would say the biggest fantasy that they used also started at the beginning of the 1970s, which was this American pop cultural and general cultural plunge into nostalgia. You know, the 60s was all about everything's new, man, it's wow. Which was, of course, a kind of extreme version of what America had always been. Embracing the new, let's do something new, let's move somewhere new, let's invent something new. And it reached a kind of, as I call it, peak new in the late 1960s. And then, oh my gosh, let's go back to Bedford Falls. Wasn't it, look, American Graffiti, wasn't it nice just before the 60s? Yeah, And so and I document how sudden and total and strange that was in the 1970s, this embrace of nostalgia and the recent-ish past in so many ways. The right, the Reaganites, used that brilliantly, beautifully. You know, look, go back, if people haven't seen it, the 1984 ad that maybe the best ad, political ad ever for Ronald Reagan's reelection, which basically made the present day in 1984 and its wonderfulness attributable to one term of Reagan look like the past. It was like, look, we've made it like a beautiful small town with all white people. Isn't that fantastic? It's morning in America. But in so many ways, they use that. Like, let's go back. Yeah, no, the 60s, that was crazy. Let's go back before that. Now, how far you want to go back before that and exactly what we mean by that, back then, of course, the racism and misogyny were all dog whistly, unlike now. I would say that's the biggest fantasy, that we could go back in the past. And that this nostalgic idea of living in some old timey America was a realizable idea. But then specifically, I mean, I would say, you know, what they named supply side economics, which is to say you radically reduce income taxes for rich people and corporations, and somehow that money will all go down to everybody and all boats will continue rising. Well, it didn't happen. And it hasn't happened again and again and again for 40 years as they keep making that case, as they did as recently as 2017, you know, when they reduced taxes by a couple of $1 trillion. So that supply side fantasy is a disproven economic fantasy, but it's still the one that the right and the Republicans trot out every time they're in power.
I want to talk about the mechanism of that nostalgia, because I find that fascinating. And certainly, I mean, I keep bringing back turn of the century, but, you know, in that era, I was in Hollywood, and I was in entertainment, and that was even in the late 90s. This nostalgia was still in very much effect. I mean, it was a machine that would just pump stuff out. And I had theories about what was going on at that time, that it had to do with, you know, because I had a lot of involvement with entertainment executives. And there was, I think, a lot of people who were simply arrested in their development, and they were going back and trying to relive their childhood in a way when they could experience it in a different way than maybe they, you know, look, there's a lot of people in show business whose childhoods were not optimal, and they want to go back and re-experience that. But what was going on in the 70s? I mean, as you mentioned, like, I'm, you know, I remember the Reagan ads, but I'm thinking like Lords of Flatbush, Happy Days. I mean, there were Laverne and Shirley. I mean, there was all these things.
Correct.
These were major shows that were it, and you know, that were going backwards to and selling it to kids. And this is, you know, I mean, there was a whole raft. What was the impetus behind that? Was it just you want to get pre-racial?
Pardon me?
We want to be pre-racial on some level?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to imagine that wasn't part of it. Mostly unconsciously. That like, oh, before the war. And by the way, I never realized until I was researching Fantasyland, because I'm stupid, that antebellum, which we think of as when slavery existed before the Civil War, meant that specifically. It means before any war. So antebellum, before the Vietnam War and all of its, oh my gosh, look at all, what that said. And before civil rights and when it was all, and before women were in the workplace. So I do think much of that pleasure that white America especially suddenly took in looking back at the past with all those TV shows you mentioned, as well as a million movies. I mean, again, I catalog them here. It's amazing how many of the big movies in the 70s, from Animal House to Godfather, and dozens more, were, oh, look, wow, the early 60s, oh, wow, the 50s, oh, wow, the 40s, that was great. So it was, and I think it was partly the you know, pre-civil rights, pre-women's liberation fantasy. But I also think, you know, more charitably, some of it was just this kind of the 60s was discombobulating. Whatever you thought of the achievements of the 60s, and I'm all for most of them, it was still exhausting. Like, oh, God, everything is so new, so all the time. And things changed back then in a year as much as they change in a decade or two now. I mean, it was nuts. So I think part of it, again, charitably, was just like, oh, let's get back to normal again. But the thing you say about show business executives wanting to live there or have a redo of their youth, I think that's true. And I think it's true of starting with baby boomers, this sort of refusal to grow up in a certain way. And whether it's a nostalgia for a particular time, it is this nostalgia for their lost adolescence. Like, they wanted to be teenagers forever. And so they started, adults, as they never had, started wearing jeans and sneakers and getting high and listening to rock and roll. And like, there was no stop to that. You know, you could do that at 30 and 40 and 50 and 60. So, and then every generation subsequent to the baby boomers kept on doing that. So I think that is a piece of the nostalgia, but it's, as you're suggesting, a more kind of personalized one. Like, let's make it like I'm a cool kid or a cooler kid in 18 when I was 18, and kind of live that way forever. Which, you know, as you know, there are certain people in Hollywood who follow that routine.
Indeed. And just as you were saying about that nostalgia, all I'm thinking about is, you know, that's what Archie Bunker was, right? I mean, they literally opened their show every night about singing about how we want to go back to a time where we understood the rules more, as to, you know, men were men and, et cetera, et cetera.
And there was no welfare and Herbert Hoover was president. Yes, exactly.
So, all right. So we have this. Let's go through some of just the history, because I think one of the things that that you do quite well is bring together these sort of disparate economic pushes that that come out of that you know are neoliberal. And almost like classically neoliberal, right? Milton Friedman came out of a tradition that started with Mont Pelerin, and these ideas find their way into the sort of the body politic, you know, some much of which is like, or at least the outline on how to disseminate these comes from the Lewis Powell memo. Who ultimately ended up very shortly after writing that becoming a Supreme Court justice.
Hey, so, it was two whole months.
You know, Nixon, that was a good memo. But just lay that out for us, that there, and like you say, it was people with aligned interests got together in some instances, actually like said, here's a project for us to do. In other instances, well, you know, it was just their interests were aligned with this. Give us a sense of what was laid out in that memo and also what it was in reaction to.
Yeah. Well, the memo, the Powell memo, which is one of these, I don't know, half dozen or 10 memos that I found. It's the most famous of them. And it's not that famous. You know of it and people know of it, but there are several memos that like, if they were in a novel about this, you'd go, that's a little on the nose. I don't think that, you know, really writing that out in advance in 1971, and then that's what happens. I don't think so. But so it was, Lewis Powell was not a right winger. Lewis Powell was a Virginia lawyer of national prominence, corporate lawyer. You know, he was a Democrat, actually, back when, you know, certain kinds of Southerners, white Southerners were Democrats who aren't now. But anyway, he wasn't a radical zealot of any kind, but it's in the late 60s, he became freaked out that, you know, all the kids are loving Ho Chi Minh and there's going to be a revolution here. I mean, and that's not an exaggeration. He talked about that kind of thing. He'd given a speech, actually, that I write about a year before he wrote the Powell memo at the behest of the Chamber of Commerce, in which he just goes whole or hog about like, this is nuts. The socialist revolution is in the air and we could all be wiped away and business will be gone. So I would say that's in his case and in many of the cases of these folks was a kind of like, oh my gosh, if this keeps going like it's gone the last 5 years in 1970-71, like we're going to be out of business. So that was part of it. But he was this very sober lawyer of great decorum and who has advised his corporate clients for decades. And that's what the Powell memo is. It's 45 page memo saying, here's what we got to do. This is how we change the public sentiment. This is how we change the elite sentiment. This is how the corporate bigwigs need to get together and lobby on behalf of corporate capitalism rather than their individual companies. And on and on and on and on. Oh, we need the law and the judiciary is a great opportunity for us. We got to do that. So he lays out, boom, piece by piece, this is what we've got to do to just save ourselves. So I think really back then it wasn't like, and then by 1980, when we have a president and we have all these, you know, sort of Democrats who are willing to go along, then we'll do this. I'm not suggesting that it was that kind of a conspiracy because nobody is that smart, or they can be evil, but they're not that geniusy. So, but he did lay it out, and immediately it was secret for a year, and then it leaked and was out. But it was immediately taken up literally by Charles Koch and other of a different kind of person, his economic libertarian crew, and in Koch's case, a zillionaire as well, a fossil fuel zillionaire as well. And it was taken and talked about as our game plan. This is what we have to do. So it wasn't just interesting and amazing in retrospect. It was a real game plan, actionable strategy at the time. So that's kind of what happened. I mean, and some people like Koch and libertarianism and Milton Friedman, who as of 1970 suddenly became famous, a celebrity economist, which previously, the people you talk about were there and they were active. They had been since the New Deal in their little fringy way. But working at it and, you know, Robert Bork and Yale and all these people, but not until the late 60s, as I argue in this book, when like, sure, anything goes, libertarianism, fine, whatever. Everybody do their own thing, including, you know, billionaires and libertarian right-wing zealots. So that was, ironically, their great opening was, you know, the counterculture. And that, the countercultural revolution, because, of course, they were a counterculture. That's the thing people need to understand. They were not, it wasn't like it was soon after. They were still fringe, freaks, right, marginalized, you know?
I mean, they're, you know, I guess that Adam Curtis film, Hypernormalcy, talks about that, yes, idea of individualism. I mean, you can see where that individualism and the lack of, you know, the individualism that came out of the 60s in terms of being able to express yourself and not have to conform and work at IBM for 50 years or whatever it was, mutates into or adopts, you know, just sort of like becomes I'm mixing a lot of metaphors here, a fertile host for this individualism as it's expressed in economics. Now, of course, neoliberal thought is actually a little bit more nuanced, and they want to put the thumb, they just want to have more control, I think, than just sort of like a complete anarchy when it comes to this. But right, you could see how that could hop along for the ride and sneak in there in some respects. And to be clear, like when the Powell memo was written, I mean, he built a molehill, right? And it turned into a mountain in many respects. But there probably was other like competing memos that you can't even find today because they just didn't work. And this one just sort of resonated because it was of the multitude of options. If you got, you know, millionaires out there, they're going to fund a bunch of this stuff. Right. And the ones that work are the ones that you still remember 40 years later, 50 years totally later.
Well, and to your point, though, he also became a Supreme Court justice shortly thereafter. And by the way, was part of some important decisions of the Supreme Court.
Nice to have an inside track.
For instance, eviscerating any attempt at campaign finance regulation, right, and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, and one does want to be careful of like looking back and saying, oh, look, of the kind of retroactive just so story of, oh, look, the Powell memo, it told everything. However, you know, you look at that again, that it wasn't just a random memo that nobody saw, but one that the billionaires took up. It was more than, I mean, yes, no doubt, there were other people doing various things. There were the two guys who started the Heritage Foundation, the right-wing think tank, just a year later. And so there were other people thinking along the same lines.
Right. I mean, called for in the memo. And, you know, we spoke to Rick Perlstein, like I say, I think it was last week, and the Heritage Foundation sort of ended up, combining forces with the evangelical right. And there's a lot of things that sort of came together in that miasma. So let's also talk about, because while you were writing, I guess, Turn of the Century, this was a period of time where I found that, like I say, I don't want to, gush too much. It was 20 years ago. I haven't
gone
sadly, but it really defined that era for me. And I think it was also just like where I was in my life at that time to watch sort of like this insanity that was taking place in New York at that time in terms of real estate, in terms of like this notion of like, I got to get involved in this like .com thing. And in fact, I did, and the company went out of business almost like
me
right
too.
After. I got the I still have mini DV cams that came from that.
No, and by for the great majority of your listeners who aren't familiar with Turn of the Century, it is a novel. It is not a nonfiction book. I used to before these last two books, I wrote novels. So yes, but I appreciate that, and it was, although it was a novel, but I mean, my conscious attempt at the time was to capture this weird moment that seemed like some kind of inflection point. Yeah, sure.
And I really think it did. But simultaneously, I mean, in Evil Geniuses, you look back on that era for yourself as one where you really weren't paying attention to what was actually going on. Oddly enough, because I found that novel very insightful of that moment, but there was another undercurrent, I guess, that you were missing. Talk about that.
I was paying attention certainly to the culture and the culture of money and idiots who would go around saying, we're creating wealth for everyone. We're creating wealth for everyone. I mean, it was satirical and it made fun of that stuff, but it was a novel and a novel that, you know, makes a big case about systemic inequality and insecurity is not really a novel. Probably I've never seen it, but you know what I'm saying? So that isn't the mission or purpose of fiction so much. However, but to your point, and I, you know, repeatedly mea culpa in Evil Geniuses, to say I wasn't really paying close enough attention or caring enough about, oh, there's a rust belt now. Oh, manufacturing workers are now losing their jobs. Too bad. That's too bad. It'll work itself out somehow, because it always works itself out, right? It's all the industrial revolutions have led to it working, sorting itself out somewhere. So yeah, I would say that my relative affluence and relative success led me to be inured to and sort of not caring enough about this systemic change. And you know, also not to you know, defend myself either, but until the 90s, at least I should have been paying more attention by the 90s, but so much of what was done was not instant. You know, they did not cancel. So they did not repeal Social Security and Medicare. They did not repeal the EPA. They did not get rid of minimum wage laws. They did all these clever, it was an undermining. It was a slow motion change from the New Deal to the Raw Deal, as I call it. So it wasn't quite clear. The cultural change was the fact that a freak like Donald Trump could be a respected, famous person in the 1980s and 1990s was clearly, you know, he was a guy who couldn't have existed in the 1970s or before. You know, this ostentatious bully. Oh, yeah, we love that. So I was aware more of the cultural changes and of some of the political changes. But I was not aware, nor was my professional mission at the time about looking at those kind of systemic political economic changes.
When did this happen? It was, in many respects, this is almost, I guess, a story of radicalization. When was the moment for you?
I would say starting in the 2000s, in the early 2000s. I mentioned an incident in the book where one day in the end of 2006, I'd gone back to my hometown of Omaha, Nebraska for the last time. My parents had died and fell in one morning and talked for a couple of hours with these two airline pilots. And like, whoa, airline pilots. You know, I still had a boy's like, whoa,
right.
These are professional heroes and all that. And they were just so, they felt ruined, cheated. The whole system had wrecked them. They didn't trust United Airlines. Why does the CEO get so much money? They lied about our pensions, on and on and on and on. And it was like a moment that made me think like, whoa, this, you know, the there is something. If I had an epiphany on the road to Damascus, it was the road to Epley Airfield in Omaha, but still, It was the thing that made me go like, wow, I have not been paying attention, and this isn't the America, you know, that I grew up in. And then I started reading harder and thinking harder, you know, and then it was slow motion. I would say, you know, sometime that took, I would say, most of a decade really to, so it was, yes, a slow motion, middle-aged radicalization. Yes.
I mean, it's interesting to me, too, because that particularly in that era, in 2005, 2006, we were seeing United Airlines. We were seeing multiple major corporations basically throw off their pension. It went into the Pension Guarantee Trust. The Pension Guarantee Trust was like under very shaky ground at that point. It was almost the end of the final nail in the coffin of defined benefit pensions right in that era.
Totally. But again, it had been coming. I mean, basically, starting in the 80s, they decided, no, that norm of giving everybody a fixed pension, we're not going to do that anymore.
Right. The experiment of the 401k came in that era, but it took all these years for it. And we see it in the context of, I mean, there's many things, the rollback of the capital gains taxes, the idea that you can buy back your own stocks. These are all things that happened in the 80s, and we don't see the impact of these really in a clear way for at least a decade or two.
Right.
It's also interesting to me that it was in Omaha that you had this moment. Having lived in New York for so many years, it was almost as if, like, you know, maybe the going back, oddly enough, and comparing it to what life was like when you were a kid or, you know, growing up might have been the sort of, you got an apples to apples sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Also, in New York, I mean, one of the problems with New York, I think, is that the creative class, the professional class, they all live together. And so therefore, if a lot of your friends and the people you see at parties and whatnot, even if you're not rich and even if you're not working on Wall Street, are rich guys working on Wall Street, it's like, oh, yeah, they're my friends. Yeah, I wouldn't do that. And they're kind of a dick in that way. But no, that's all fine. I think life in New York at the upper reaches economically tends to not serve the kind of clarity, if not radicalization, about the economic system that you're talking about. But yeah, I think Omaha was probably part of it. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. But, you know, also, Warren Buffett was a friend of my parents. Didn't make him rich, but he was a friend of theirs. And so actually that same trip to Omaha, I went and saw for the first time at this wonderful little bookshop in the airport there, this shrine to Warren Buffett and all of his books and all this, essentially, created by this really smart guy who ran the bookstore. And I began thinking about Warren Buffett and Warren Buffett as a very different kind of billionaire than, say, Donald Trump's billions, but not the kind of it's all about me and greed is good. He was a different kind of, you know, investor and rich guy. And it was also right then, which I also mentioned in the book, 2005, 2006, where Warren Buffett comes out more than once on television and says, you know, there is a class war. People, the right talks about this class war being waged. There is a class war. It's being waged by my side, by rich people, and we're winning and we shouldn't be. So, yeah, those all of those things together were part of my radicalization moment, or if that's what we want to call it, yeah.
And I will say that's also a defense as to why I have no friends anywhere. And so I am not susceptible to any of those. But
I want to talk about that. Keeps you hygienic.
Exactly. Very, very hygienic. A little bit lonely, but you work through that. So so let me ask you this in terms of like we talked about the idea of culture going back and feeding on the past, this sort of this nostalgia, this kitsch, if you will. And you observe that the culture in many respects has been in a weird stasis for the past couple of decades. Talk about that, because it does seem, I will say that the thing that has radically changed over the past 20 years, as far as I can tell, is technology and everything that is implied by that. Having a 14-year-old daughter, the interesting thing about this whole COVID thing is that I feel like her whole life has been training to maintain her relationships over Zoom, because that's what she was on some level. She was doing some version of that anyways. But beyond that, there's no outward. Talk about that sort of representation.
Well, that again, as it happens, it was an epiphany that I had around the same time, 6 months later than this era, screwed over pilots one. And I was just reading the paper and I saw this picture from 20 years earlier, 21 years earlier, I think 1985 or six, of people of this group of fashionable young people, waiters, maitre d's and so forth, who worked at the first cool boutique hotel in Manhattan. I'm saying, how weird. They all look like people today. Their hair looks like it, their grooming thing, their clothes, the stuff on the street, everything. Like, that's weird, because in any previous time in my lifetime, and then I realized before, 20 years made all the difference in the world, right? Everything in 1970 looked different. Acted radically different than 1950. Same 1980 versus 1960, 1990 versus 1970. And then it stopped. And anyway, I didn't see it as part, I thought I saw this as at the time as this entirely other thing. And I spent some time trying to figure that out, how and why that had happened. And in some ways it is an extension of nostalgia. It's like, one reason it happens is because of all the wild technological change, some of it good, a lot of it not so good, all of it discombobulating for a lot of people. There was a certain reassurance that, oh, but look, the way I dress and the way that magazine looks and the way that car looks and all of the rest, nothing's really that different, is it? It's kind of all like it always was. I mean, you know, look at you, Sam. I mean, you could walk down the street in 1990 and nobody would go, wow, look, man from the future.
I'm probably wearing the exact same clothes wore in 1990.
Exactly. So I think one of the reasons it happened, as I say, is the same reason the nostalgia mania happened. It's like, it's reassuring. And I don't think anybody made it happen or any more than anybody made the nostalgia thing happen. But I do think, and this is how I began weaving it together with the economic story, political story I tell, I think it has served to reinforce the idea that big change, radical change, reengineering the economy, say, is really not possible because everything just stays the same, doesn't it? I think it has that effect of making it seem impossible to change things, that this is just the way it is, kids. So, and again, I'm not saying that's even conscious on anybody's part, but I think it's this strange thing that happened midway through the takeover by the evil geniuses that serves their interests. Yeah.
How does that fit in? I'm just curious as to, like, if you have a take on this in terms of generationally, because it seems that, late Generation X, early Generation X, I'm at the margins of Generation X and, closer to a boomer. And I wonder, you know, when I look at younger people, people in their 30s and younger, it feels like that there is not the same inhibition of imagination that exists, certainly in my generation and amongst the boomer generation. And I wonder if that is, how much the boomers went to sort of like said, we're going to break off of the shackles of pretense and button up shirt and short hair. And there's nowhere to go after that for them. Right. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, once every day is casual Friday, you've run out of days.
Yeah.
And on some level, but like the younger people, they don't have that constraint on some level. Where does generation, what's going on here generationally?
Well, I I'm hopeful. You know, I see green shoots of hope of maybe this stasis is not altogether, you know, is going to sustain itself. But I think, you know, however, the radically new in the ways in which hip hop was radically new in the 70s and 80s, or rock and roll was radically new in the 60s, we still haven't seen that. So whatever the generational difference is, it has yet to, in a cultural way, in a pop cultural way, manifest itself in a spectacular way like those. But I also think that because the younger generation, because anybody under 45 has never lived in anything but in America an unfair, unequal, insecure economy, I think, you know, there's more of a sense of, well, what have I got to lose? Right. You know, in so many good ways, potentially if the evil geniuses retain control, it could explode and blow the whole thing up, which of course some young people, Sam, want to do. But, so I think that's part of it. The difference, but the other thing, I mean, you know, I've got kids older than yours and young people also, some of them anyway, love nothing more than using their Jetsonian technology to like look back at the 70s and the 60s and the 50s and look at videos and, you know, which is not bad in and of itself, but the accessibility of images and sounds of the past does have the effect, I think, of suppressing the rejection of the past, that big radical changes of the 60s and of 1848 and everything else before tended to occur. I mean, there has to be some kind of rejection of the past. And God knows we have a rejection of the racial past, racial oppression past, and the misogynistic past, and that's going good. But like, and I think in the last decade with the Bernieites and even Warrenites like me, I am hopeful that that people are seeing more clearly that this current, the way the system has been re-engineered, well, that it was re-engineered, and that it was re-engineered not to serve most people, and it doesn't have to be this way, you know? So we'll see. But it is, you know, no, I am prodded and educated and re-educated all the time by my daughters. So good luck with, I hope you are too.
Yeah, I am indeed. And I should say your insistence on using political economy as opposed to just the term economy is yeah. One that I think sort of goes to the heart of trying to remind people, like, these are choices. This is not, we're not in an organic situation here. This is not about, this is not gravity or physics. This is simply people making a choice to drop a hammer. That's why it fell to the ground.
Exactly right.
All right. So lastly, where does, and you end the book on a hopeful note, and you give some suggestions as to how to move forward, but where does, how do you, I guess, digest, metabolize Joe Biden as our savior in this instance? I mean, I maybe it's slightly overstated, but I mean, as the guy that is at the very least, you know, people are hoping will put an end at least to Trump, and then theoretically maybe open the door a tiny crack or something, or at least maybe make it, you know, unlock the door, not necessarily open it. I mean, where how do you? How
well,
do you,
I mean, because, you know, what the right calls Trump derangement syndrome, I fully have. And until that first step is taken care of, I can almost look no further. But in this book, I do, because it's a book and I have to look at the future. So I think if the Democrats are elected, I think if Biden and Harris are elected, and if the Democrats take the U.S. Senate, that's a huge first step to beginning what needs doing. And Joe Biden, you know, he, unlike some of the other people, I think, in these who are Democratic Party centrists, my sense is that he's less ideologically centrist than he is just, I don't know if that's practical. You know, that he will move where his party has moved. And his party on these economic questions has moved, obviously, significantly to the left in the last decade. So, and what was, what, you know, the Obama administration in 2009 decided, no, we can't go for public option health care because that's too radical, now is the Joe Biden position. So I am hopeful that he as just a, I don't want to say as just a Democrat who puts his finger to the wind and does what Democrats want, because that can be a bad thing. I think in this instance, it's kind of a good thing. So I'm hopeful. My first great disappointment would come when we see who he appoints to be Treasury Secretary and head of the Office of Management and Budget and all those jobs, and whether it's just, you know, more, you know, Wall Street guys, But I'm hopeful. And also a perverse thing that made me hopeful in the last few weeks is I went back and looked at Donald Trump's final big 2-minute campaign ad in 2016. And I swear to you, It's worth looking at. It could be a Bernie Sanders commercial. He does. It's from a speech he gave. Is the voiceover? It's all these scenes of Wall Street and bankers and Lloyd Blankfein and they have destroyed the working class in America and taken the wealth and given it. It's wild, right? And this is a guy who also campaigned on universal health care will be better than ever for you. You know, people voted for him for partly, many people, for those reasons, thinking, nah, he's not a Republican like those guys. Well, clearly that was his biggest lie of all. But my point in this conversation is that there is an audience for, a constituency for, greater economic fairness and greater scrutiny of Wall Street and big business that isn't, you know, just on the left. Obviously, that was part of the Bernie Sanders plan since, right, you know, for the last 5 years of running for president. But I think, you know, I think there's some truth to it. And I think if where the Democrats are now is embodied by Joe Biden, and I think that there's a fair shot of that happening, then, you know, it's one good, important, small step in that direction.
Do you think people are going to, lastly, do you think people are going to stay engaged? I mean, one of the things that I remember after Bill Clinton got elected is that there was this sort of like collective sigh of relief that the Reagan era was over, including, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush. Same on some level with Obama. Bush is done. Good. We can move on. And then that means that, you know, I no longer have to look at the politics section of
100%.
Whatever it is. And everybody, you know, that centrist Democrat. And I would say in the book, I just want to make clear that people should know that you really recount the Democratic sort of buy into all this stuff. I didn't know that stuff about Gary Hart and Arthur Laffer. It doesn't shock me knowing Hart's profile, but it sort of shocks me, you know, like that anybody even after, you know, what Laffer did in Kansas, we still have too much of Laffer, is not mocked enough, I think. But do you think that people, and I'm talking in many respects, people, my generation, your generation, are going to just basically say, phew, no Donald Trump. Now I can go back and what's on HBO this week?
Sure. And I think we should also remember that is the way most Americans are about politics all the time. Even now, you know, I mean, I talk to friends of mine who are political reporters who are out in the field talking to all kinds of people all the time, voters. And they always remind me, like, you know, 60% or more of people just barely paid attention, and certainly until last week or this week, haven't paid much attention. So yes, that is the default, is to return to that mean, which is why, you know, the people who care are engaged, like the right, the economic right did in the 70s and 80s, got to have people on the left need to look at this and have a play a long game and keep at it. And the 10% or 20% or 30% or whatever who are engaged and care and aren't just going to be, oh my God, I don't have to think about Washington and the president anymore. And by the way, a lot of us who are engaged will also feel that a little bit. But I think, you know, it needs to be a long game with clear principles that people keep pushing and keep pushing. Because one of the things I realized after I mostly finished this book was that it is part of its purpose, perhaps, is a guidebook for what we can do now. They had a lot of could do this more efficiently in lots of ways than the left could. They had corporations, yeah, and it was an easier for these guys to execute on a long game. But I think there's lots of lessons here. And people like AOC, I think, to my mind, you know, she's playing the long game. I feel like, I mean, and to hear her talk about, you know, what, how we need to get ourselves ready for a fully automated AI future. She's playing in many different lanes at once, and she's not such a, you know, oh, she's a zealot who will never compromise to in order to govern. She's already shown to me that she's not that, and she has compromised, and she's playing the game in a good way. So I until I am rendered entirely hopeless for the first time in my life, which could happen on November 4th or whenever we find out who won, I'm kind of hopeful.
Kurt Anderson, the book is Evil Geniuses, The Unmasking of America, A Recent History. Folks can check that out. We will post it to a majority at IFM. Thank you so much for your time.
It was a pleasure. This was a great conversation.
Well, thank you. All right. I appreciate it. All right, folks. I don't know why it took me so long. You should have been the first guest on the Majority Report with Janine and I. I mean, maybe not necessarily the first, but very early, because turn of the century really captured the sort of craziness in that was happening in New York City at that time.
Yeah. Took a little bit of a different approach with him than you did with Stuart Stevens, didn't you?
I sort of I didn't hit him as hard as I hit Stevens. Stuart Stevens. Hey, but Stuart Stevens says he wants to come back. So maybe next time it'll be maybe next time we can, I don't know. I still have a couple of questions for Stuart Stevens. That, you know, you get into the middle of it and I got my papers here and they get shuffled around and I'm like, I got to hit this point. I got to hit that point. You don't want to come right out the gate and go after the guy. I know there was a lot of people I heard were like, I only listened for like the first 4 minutes. I was so disgusted. I had to turn it off. And then I went back later and, it got a little better, I got to admit, I'm a bigger fan of Kurt Anderson's than I am Stuart Stevens. I'm not saying I don't like Stuart Stevens. I just don't know him. So, folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you make the free show possible every single day. And then, as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. We originally started this, it was going to be 45 minutes free, 45 minutes for the members. And then it just, every moment up until as I'm preparing for the show is just ranges from like tolerable to sometimes just pure misery. And then when the show starts, I enjoy it too much and I can't stop talking. And then I go back to just sort of like tolerable after that, like at 3 p.m. That's basically... If you were to graph my mood, it goes like, it's just like this and then maybe die and then just spikes. And then it's like, anyways, you get an hour and a half for the membership. Today in the office was just a disaster. Like Matt, I had to like I threw a fit. Like we tested it out and I threw a fit like 10:30. I'm like, I can't do this. I just can't do it. And there's no having way I can do this. And I flipped out and Matt's like, I'll come into the office. And I'm like, thank you. I think I probably even said that like in the corner to myself, probably.
Matt, wait, this is all technological stuff? This is like,
this is what?
This is all technology? I missed like part of this conversation. Yeah, I just heard that you're miserable all the time and then you're on air.
I'm in the Brooklyn studio.
Okay,
and
got it.
The studio is not set up to do this remote thing, oddly enough. My other studio is, because that's all I would ever do from there is remote.
Right.
So here, like, you know, I'm surrounded by all these cameras and the only one that is actually relevant is this webcam that I put on top of this tripod.
Yeah.
And I got all these cables going all these different places. And the only one that's relevant is this one that like I patched together with like an old Radio Shack, thing that I soldered and put some duct tape around. And that's the thing. And that's it. And so Matt had to come in and save the day. And so that's that.
So also, that you could see your guests, right? Is that that's the thing that's happening?
No, it's not even them. So much to see a guest. It's the whole sound, routing the sound for the phones and all these different things.
Oh, yeah. You've got the phone.
And thing. Like our Zoom setup, it's not really Zoom. It is Zoom, but we run it through fans, as you know, is different than being in the studio. and in terms of the way that we go live. And so, you know, it's just like
why people need to give you money and us money so we can build better studios, and then we can crowdsource it together and just have it for everyone.
That's what Kyle is doing with Fans. I mean, he's creating something that I think is going to be accessible to a lot of people, and it's going to make it much easier. And you know, every day it feels like there's another feature that he adds that makes this possible. But it's also very weird because we're planning for a future that we do not know. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, are we going to be doing it this way for 6 months, 3 months, 20 months? Oh, okay. All right, we got to get going. I know you've got your show today at 3, and I don't want to bust through that today. Just want to remind everybody, AMQ, you can check out the AM Quickie. It's free. You can sign up at amquickie.com. You can check it out on our YouTube page at Majority Report Live. But you can find it on any of your podcast things. And also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Those guys are movement people. In addition to they're to co-op, but they are you know, in Madison, Wisconsin, longtime movement supporters of the show. The other day, I was talking about the Cernovich thing to somebody, and it was basically Just Coffee that saved me. Cernovich sent fake emails to all the sponsors, and I had no way of knowing this. And until.
Saying what? What were the fake email? Like, it was.
Oh, like during the whole thing where, like, yeah. Sam Cedar supports child rapists. And right. I'm a member of Child Rapist Survivors, you know, Association. And it scared a lot of advertisers. I understand this. I mean, they're not in that business. But the one advertiser, I got an email immediately from Just Coffee, and they're like, I don't buy this Cernovich. And like, cause these guys, they're fans of the show. They're, and by guys, I mean guys and girls, guys and gals.
Folks.
I refer to everybody as guys. Like, I say that my daughter refers to me as girl, and I refer to her as guy. Like, guy, come on. But like, I sent her a video the other night, last night, and she's like, girl, I saw this in 2012.
She literally said, girl, I saw
this. Yeah. She texted me. She's like, girl, I saw this in 2012. I'm like, all right.
She's not doing it ironically. This is like literally just like, girl, get with it.
She just, that's like the way she talks. But the Just Coffee people contacted me, and that's what got everything in motion. And then Matt actually had to run into studio that night too. But that's a different story. No. Matt. What's going on? I'm building out a Murphy bed for Matt here. Tell me, what's going on with you?
I have also been dealing with technology issues. I am way less sophisticated than you are when it comes to this. But we are very exciting news today. We go daily, sort of daily. Tuesdays through Fridays, we are going to have our show 1 hour, 3 p.m. Eastern to 4 p.m. Eastern. And today's show, we are talking about evictions, and we're talking about the police. Two very important topics. Chris Brown, who's an attorney who has done a lot of activism around protecting victims of police brutality. He's going to give us a little bit of an update on what's actually going on. Are there any reforms happening? And then later we have Representatives Chris Rabb from Pennsylvania and Representative Mike Conley from Massachusetts to talk about the eviction crisis and if anything is moving anywhere in any legislature. And these are two extremely progressive, probably some of the most I am aware of in this country.
What district is Connolly?
He isn't.
State rep.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know off the top of my head, but he's a Democratic Socialist. He was a member before he ran. He got elected in 2016. And Representative Rabb has the highest turnout in Pennsylvania. He's by far the most left candidate in Pennsylvania, or elected in Pennsylvania. Someone, a rising star, I think, you know. He's back from, like, the Netroots days. I'm surprised you did. Do you know him, Chris Rabb?
I feel like I do. Yeah. I feel like
he
I do.
He used to, like, blog back in the day.
I can't remember. Can't remember anything anymore. What was the name of the guy who I was talking about before? Oh, Matt. Matt, what's happening on TMBS tonight?
Tonight on TMBS, we have a conversation with Milton Alamadi of Black Star News. We're talking about the coup in Mali. Yoweri Museveni, the Ugandan president, he's attacking his political opponent, Bobby Wine, saying he's 40 and while he's passed himself off as 38. And so we talk about that sort of what's going on with elections in Uganda. And then, yeah, we also will touch on Kenosha and a bit more. So that's tonight on TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS and the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
You got to fix that internet, Pat, if you're going to try and do that tonight.
Oh, is my internet, Pat? Okay.
Getting a little bit of like that wow, wow, wow thing. all right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. We will take your phone calls. We will take some IMs and see you there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.